smile. There had been about a minute when they'd first met that Bull had seriously considered whether he found her attractive. But if he'd seen the same calculus in her, they'd gotten past it.
"Didn't go so good?"
Sam asked.
"No."
Sam lifted her eyebrows and leaned her elbows against the tabletop. He sketched out Pa's objections and rationale, and Sam's expression shifted slowly into a fatalistic amusement. "Waiting for the refit's all well and good," she said when he was done. "But if we try and test fire that bad boy, it's going to make an awfully big owie."
"You sure about that?"
"Not 100%, she said. "High 80s, though." Bull sighed out a tired obscenity as the barkeep brought the bulbs of lemonade. They were about the size of Bull's bald fists, citrus yellow, with Malisha Potiehi printed on the side in bright red script.
"Maybe I should talk to her," Sam said.
"If it came straight from me..."
"It came straight from you, probably it would work," he said. "And they get to tell me no on everything from now on." "Bull asked for it? Well, if it was important, he'd have sent the belter, right?"
"You really think it's about you not getting born up here?"
"Yeah."
"Well, you're probably right," Sam said. "Sorry about that."
"Comes with the territory,"
Bull said, pretending that it didn't bother him. Sam plucked her lemonade off the table and took a long, thoughtful drink. The bulb clicked when the magnet readhered to the tabletop.
"I've got nothing against inners.
Worked with a lot of you guys, and didn't run into a higher percentage of assholes than when I'm dealing with belters. But I have to get that railgun's mounts reinforced. If there's a way to do that without undercutting you, I'm all for it."
"But if it's that, or mess up the ship," Bull said, nodding. "Give me a little time. I'll think of something."
"Start when you want to shoot someone and count back 18 days, Sam said. "That's my deadline. Even if everyone's sober and working balls out, my crew can't get it done faster than that."
"I'll think of something," Bull said.
The larceny complaint turned out to be from a repair and maintenance crew who couldn't agree how to store their tools. The injury report was a kid who got caught between a stretch of deck plating and someone driving a salvage mech. The cartilage in the kid's knee had gotten ground into about a dozen different bits of custard. The medic said a good, clean bone break would have been better. The injured man would be fine, but he was off active duty for at least a month while all his pieces got glued back together. The security reports were boilerplate, which either meant that things were going well or that the problems were getting glossed over, but probably they were going well. The trip out to the ring was a shakedown cruise, and that always meant there'd be a little honeymoon period when the crew were all figuratively standing shoulder to shoulder and taking on the work. Everyone expected there'd be problems, so there was a grace period when morale didn't start heading down. Chief security officer on an OPA ship was a half-assed kind of position, one part cop, one part efficiency expert, and pretty much all den mother to a crew of 1,000 people with their own agendas and petty power struggles and opinions on how he should be doing his job better. A good security chief kept bullshit off the captain's plate as a full-time job. The worst part, though, was that all Bull's formal duties were focused inward, on the ship. Right now, a flotilla of Earth ships was burning out into the deep night, a matching force of Martian war vessels, the remnants of the Navy that had survived two, let's not call them wars, was burning out on a converging path. The behemoth was lumbering along too, with a head start that came from being farther from the sun and the hobble of low-G acceleration to keep her slow. And all of it was focused on the ring. Reports would be filling Captain Ashford's queue, and as his XO, Pa would be reading them too. Bull had whatever scraps they let him have, or else the same mix of pabulum and panic that filled the news feeds. Ashford and Pa would be in conference for most of their shifts, working over strategies and options and playing through scenarios for how things might go down when they reached the ring. Bull was going to worry about all the trivial stuff so that they didn't have to. And somehow, he was going to make the mission work, because Fred had asked him to.
Hey, Chief, Serge said.
Bull looked up from the terminal feed in his desk. Serge stood in the office doorway.
Shift's up, and I'm out.
All right, Bull said. I still got some stuff. I can lock up when I'm done.
Bien, Alice, Serge said with a nod.
His light, shuffling footsteps hissed through the front room. In the corridor, Gutmann's daughter stroked his white beard and Casimir said something that made them both chuckle. Corin lifted her chin to Serge as he stepped out. The door closed behind him. When he was sure he was alone, Bull pulled up the operational plan and started hunting. He didn't have authority to change it, but that didn't mean he couldn't change anything. 2 hours later, when he was done, he turned off the screen and stood. The office was dark and colder than he liked it. The hum of the ventilation system comforted him. If it were ever completely silent, that would be the time to worry. He stretched, the vertebrae between his shoulder blades crunching like gravel. They would still be in the bar, most likely. Serge and Corin and Casimir. Macondo and Garza, so similar they could have been brothers. Jojo. His people, to the degree that they were his. He should go. Be with them. Make friends. He should go to his bunk.
Come on, old man, he said. Time to get some rest.
He had closed and locked the office door before Sam's voice came to him in his memory. Even if everyone's sober and working balls out, my crew can't get it done faster than that. He hesitated, his wide fingers over the keypad. It was late. He needed food and sleep, and an hour or so checking in with the family aggregator his cousin had set up 3 years before to help everyone keep track of who was living where. He had a container of flash-frozen green chili from Hatch back on Earth waiting for him. It was all going to be there in the morning, and more besides. He didn't need to make more work for himself. No one was going to thank him for it. He went back in, turned his desk back on, and reread the injury report. Sam had a good laugh. One that came from the gut. It filled the machining bay, echoing off ceiling and walls until it sounded like there was a crowd of her. Two of the techs on the far side turned to look toward her, smiling without knowing what they were smiling about.
Technical support, she said. You've got to be kidding.
Railgun's a pretty technical piece of equipment, Bull said. It needs support.
So you redefined what I do as technical support.
Yeah.
That's never going to fly, she said.
Then get the job done quick, Bull said.
Ashford will put you up for disciplinary action, she said, the amusement fading but not quite gone yet.
He has that right. But there's this other thing I wanted to talk about. You said something yesterday about how long it would take to do the job if everyone in your crew was sober.
It was like turning off a light. The smile left Sam's face as if it had never been there. She crossed her arms, tiny half-moon shapes dented in at the corners of her mouth, making her look older than she was. Bull nodded to her like she'd said something.
You've got techs coming to work high, he said.
Sometimes, she said.
And then, reluctantly, some of it's alcohol, but mostly it's pixie dust to make up for lack of sleep.
I got a report about a kid got his knee blown out. His blood was clean, but it doesn't look like anyone tested the guy who was driving the mech. Driver isn't even named in the report. Weird, eh?
If you say so, she said. Bull looked down at his feet. The gray and black service utility boots. The spotless floor.
I need a name, Sam.
You know I can't do that, she said. These assholes are my crew. If I lose their respect, we're done here.
I won't bust your guys unless they're dealing.
You can't ask me to pick sides. And sorry for saying this, but you already don't have a lot of friends around here. You should be careful how you alienate people.
Across the bay, the two technicians lifted a broken mech onto a steel repair hoist. The murmur of their conversation was just the sound of words without the words themselves. If he couldn't hear them, Bull figured they couldn't hear him.
Yeah. So, Sam?
Bull?
I'm gonna need you to pick sides.
He watched her vacillate. It only took a few seconds. Then he looked across the bay. The technicians had the mech open, pulling an electric motor out of its spine. It was smaller than a six-pack of beer and built to put out enough torque to rip steel. Not the sort of thing to play with drunk. Sam followed his gaze and his train of thought.
For a guy who bends so many rules, you can be pretty fucking uncompromising.
Strong believer in doing what needs to get done.
It took her another minute, but she gave him a name. Chapter 6. Holden.
Uranus is really far away, Naomi said as they walked along the corridor to the docking bay. It was the third objection to the contract that she'd listed so far, and something in her voice told Holden there were a lot more points on her list. Under other circumstances, he would have thought she was just angry that he'd accepted the job. She was angry, but not just.
Yes, he said,
it is. And Titania is a shitty little moon with one tiny little science base on it, Naomi continued.
Yes?
We could buy Titania for what it cost these people to hire us to fly out there, Naomi said. Holden shrugged. This part of Ceres was a maze of cheap warehouse tunnels and even cheaper office space. The walls were the grungy off-white of spray-on insulation foam. Someone with a pocket knife and a few minutes to kill could reach the bedrock of Ceres without much effort. From the ratty look of the corridor, there were a lot of people with knives and idle time. A small forklift came down the corridor toward them with an electric whine and a constant high-pitched beep. Holden backed up against the wall and pulled Naomi to him to get her out of its way. The driver gave Holden a tiny nod of thanks as she drove by.
So why are they hiring us? She asked. Demanded.
Because we're awesome?
Titania has, what, a couple hundred people living at the science base? Naomi said. You know how they usually send supplies out there. They load them into a single-use braking rocket and fling them at Uranus's orbit with a rail gun.
Usually, Holden agreed.
And the company? Outer Fringe Exports? If I was making a cheap, disposable shell corporation, you know what I'd call it?
Outer Fringe Exports?
Outer Fringe Exports, she said. Naomi stopped at the entry hatch that opened the rental docking bay and the Rosinante. The sign overhead listed the present user. Outer Fringe Exports. Holden started to reach for the controls to cycle the pressure doors open, but Naomi put a hand on his arm. These people are hiring a warship to transport something to Titania, she said, lowering her voice as though afraid someone might be listening. How can they possibly afford to do that? Our cargo hold is the size of a hatbox.
We gave them a good rate, Holden said, trying for funny and failing.
What would someone be sending to Titania that requires a fast, stealthy, and heavily armed ship? Have you asked what's in those crates we signed up to carry?
No, Holden said. No, I haven't. And I normally would, but I'm trying really hard not to find out.
Naomi frowned at him, her face shifting between angry and concerned.
Why?
Holden pulled out his hand terminal and called up an orbital map of the solar system.
See this? All the way on this edge?
This is the ring. He scrolled the display to the other edge of the solar system. And this is Uranus. They are literally the two spots furthest from each other in the universe that have humans near them.
And?
Naomi said. Holden took a deep breath. He could feel a surge of the anxiety he always tried to deny leaping up in him, and he pushed it back down.
And I know I don't talk about it much, but something really unpleasant and really big with a really high body count knows my name, and it's connected to the ring.
Miller, Naomi said.
The ring opened, and he knew when it happened. It was the closest thing to making sense he's done since he rose from the dead.
The words didn't fit in his throat, and Naomi didn't make him say them. Her nod was enough. She understood. In an act of legendary cowardice, he was running away to the other side of the solar system to avoid Miller and the ring, and everything that had to do with them. If they had to transport black market human organs or drugs or sex bots or whatever was in those crates, he'd do it, because he was scared. Her eyes were unreadable. After all this time, she could still keep her thoughts out of her expression when she wanted to.
Okay, Naomi said, and pushed the entry door open for him.
At the outer edge of Ceres, where the spin gravity was greatest, Holden almost felt like he could have been on Luna or Mars. Loading gantries fed into the skin of the station like thick veins, waiting for the mechs to load in the cargo. Poorly patched scars marked the walls where accidents had marred them. The air smelled of coolant, and the kind of cheap air filters that reminded Holden of urinal cakes. Amos lounged on a small electric power lift. His eyes closed.
We get the job?
We did, Naomi said.
Amos cracked an eye open as they came near. A single frown line drew itself on his broad forehead.
We happy about that? He asked.
We're fine with it, Naomi said. Let's get the lift warmed up. Cargo's due in 10 minutes, and we probably want to get it off station as quickly as we can without raising suspicion.
There was a beauty in the efficiency that came from a crew that had flown together as long as they had. A fluidity and intimacy and grace that grew from long experience. 8 minutes after Holden and Naomi had come in, the Rosie was ready to take on cargo. 10 minutes later, nothing happened. Then 20. Then an hour. Holden paced the gantry nearest the entry hatch, with an uncomfortable tingling crawling up the back of his neck.
You sure we got this job?
Amos asked.
These guys seemed really sketchy to me, Naomi said over the comm from her station in ops. I'd think we've been scammed, except we haven't given anyone our account numbers.
We're on the clock here, boss, Alex said from the cockpit. These loading docks charge by the minute.
Holden bit back his irritation and said, I'll call again. He pulled out his terminal and connected to the export company's office. Their messaging system responded, as it had the last 3 times he'd requested a connection. He waited for the beep that would let him leave another message. Before he could, his display lit up with an incoming connection request from the same office. He switched to it.
Holden here.
This is a courtesy call, Captain Holden, the voice on the other end said. The video feed was the Outer Fringe Exports logo on a gray background.
We're withdrawing the contract, and you might want to consider leaving that dock very, very soon.
You can't back out now, Holden said, trying to keep his voice calm and professional against the rising panic he felt.
We've signed the deal. We've got your deposit. It's non-refundable.
Keep it, his caller said. But we consider your failure to inform us of your current situation as a prior breach.
Situation? Holden thought. They couldn't know about Miller. He didn't think they could.
The party that's tracking you left our offices about 5 minutes ago, so you should probably get off Ceres in a hurry. Goodbye, Mr. Holden.
Wait, Holden said. Who was there? What's going on?
The call ended. Amos was rubbing his pale, stubble-covered scalp with both hands. He sighed and said,
We got a problem, right?
Yep.
Be right back,
Amos replied, and climbed off the forklift. Alex, how long till we can clear this dock? Holden asked. He loped across the bay to the entry hatch. There didn't seem to be any way to lock it from his side. Why would there be? The bays were temporary rental space for loading and unloading cargo. No need for security.
She's warmed up, Alex replied, not asking the obvious question. Holden was grateful for that.
Give me 10 to run the decoupling sequence, that should do it.
Start now, Holden said, hurrying back toward the airlock.
Leave the lock open till the last minute. Amos and I will be out here making sure no one interferes.
Roger that, Cap,
Alex replied and dropped the connection.
Interferes? Naomi said.
What's going on? Okay, why is Amos going out there with a shotgun?
Those sketchy, scary gangster types we just signed on with?
Yes. They just dropped us. And whatever scared them into doing it is coming here right now. I don't think guns are an overreaction. Amos ran down the ramp, holding his auto shotgun in his right hand and an assault rifle in his left. He tossed the rifle to Holden, then took up a cover position behind the forklift and aimed at the bay's entry hatch. Like Alex, he didn't ask why.
Want me to come out? Naomi asked.
No, but prepare to defend the ship if they get past me and Amos, Holden replied, then moved over to the forklift's recharging station.
It was the only other cover in the otherwise empty bay. In a conversational tone, Amos said,
Any idea what we're expecting here?
Nope, Holden said.
He clicked the rifle to auto-fire and felt a faint nausea rising in his throat.
All right then, Amos said cheerfully.
8 minutes, Naomi said from his hand terminal. Not a long time, but if they were trying to hold the bay under hostile fire, it would seem like an eternity.
The entry warning light at the cargo bay entrance flashed yellow 3 times, and the hatch slid open.
Don't shoot unless I do, Holden said quietly. Amos grunted back at him.
A tall, blonde woman walked into the bay. She had an Earther's build, a video star's face, and couldn't have been more than 20. When she saw the 2 guns pointed at her, she raised her hands and wiggled her fingers.
Not armed, she said.
Her cheeks dimpled into a grin. Holden tried to imagine why a supermodel would be looking for him.
Hi,
Amos said. He was grinning back at her.
Who are you?
Holden said, keeping his gun trained on her.
My name's Audrey. Are you James Holden?
I can be, Amos said, if you want.
She smiled. Amos smiled back, but his weapon was still in a carefully neutral position.
What have we got down there? Naomi asked, her voice tense in his ear. Do we have a threat?
I don't know yet, Holden said.
You are, though, right? You're James Holden, Audrey said, walking toward him.
The assault rifle in his hands didn't seem to bother her at all. Up close, she smelled like strawberries and vanilla.
Captain James Holden of the Rocinante?
Yes, he said.
She held out a slim, throwaway hand terminal. He took it automatically. The terminal displayed a picture of him, along with his name and his UN citizen and UN naval ID numbers. You've been served, she said. Sorry,
It was nice meeting you, though. She turned back to the door and walked away.
What the fuck? Amos said to no one, dropping the muzzle of his gun to the floor and rubbing his scalp again.
Jim? Naomi said.
Give me a minute.
He paged through the summons, jumping past 7 pages of legalese to get to the point. The Martians wanted their ship back. Official proceedings had been started against him in both Earth and Martian courts, challenging the salvage claim to the Rocinante. Only they were calling it the Tachi. The ship was under an order of impound pending adjudication, effective immediately. His short conversation with Outer Fringe Export suddenly made a lot more sense.
Cap, Alex said through the connection, I'm getting a red light on the docking clamp release. I'm putting a query in. Once I get that cleared, we can pop the cork.
What's going on out there? Naomi asked. Are we still leaving? Holden took a long, deep breath, sighed, and said something obscene. The longest layover the Rocinante had taken since Holden and the others had gone independent had been 5.5 weeks. The 12 days that the Rossi spent in lockup seemed longer. Naomi and Alex were on the ship most of the time, putting inquiries through to lawyers and legal aid societies around the system. With every letter and conversation, the consensus grew. Mars had been smart to begin legal proceedings in Earth courts as well as their own. Even if Holden and the Rossi slipped the leash at Ceres, all major ports would be denied them. They'd have to skulk from one gray market belter port to the next. Even if there was enough work, they might not be able to find supplies to keep them flying. If they took the case before a magistrate, they might or might not lose the ship, but it would be expensive to find out. Accounts that Holden had thought of as comfortably full suddenly looked an order of magnitude too small. Staying on Ceres Station made him antsy. Being on the Rossi left him sad. There had been any number of times in his travels on the Rossi that he'd imagined, even expected, it all to come to a tragic end. But those scenarios had involved firefights or alien monstrosities or desperate dives into some planetary atmosphere. He'd imagined with a sick thrill of dread what it would be like if Alex died, or Amos, or Naomi. He'd wondered whether the three of them would go on without him. He hadn't considered that the end might find them all perfectly fine, that the Rocinante might be the one to go. Hope, when it came, was a documentary streamcast team from UN Public Broadcasting. Monica Stewart, the team lead, was an auburn-haired, freckled woman with a professionally sculpted beauty that made her seem vaguely familiar when he saw her on the screen of the pilot's deck. She hadn't come in person.
How many people are we talking about?
Holden asked.
4, she said. 2 camera jockeys, my sound guy, and me.
Holden ran a hand across 8 days' worth of patchy beard. The sense of inevitability sat in his gut like a stone.
To the ring, he said.
To the ring, she agreed. We need to make it a hard burn to get there before the Martians, the Earth flotilla, and the behemoth, and we'd like some measure of safety once we're out there, which the Rocinante would be able to give us. Naomi cleared her throat, and the documentarian shifted her attention to her.
You're sure you can get the hold taken off the Rossi?
Naomi asked.
I'm protected by the Freedom of Journalism Act. I have the right to the reasonable use of hired materials and personnel in the pursuit of a story. Otherwise, anyone could stop any story they didn't like by malicious use of injunctions like the one on the Rossi. I have a backdated contract that says I hired you a month ago, before I arrived at Ceres. I have a team of lawyers 10 benches deep who can drown anyone that objects in enough paperwork to last a lifetime.
So, we've been working for you all along, Holden said.
Only if you want to get that docking lock rescinded. But it's more than just a ride I'm looking for. That's what makes it reasonable that I can't just hire a different ship.
I knew there was a but, Holden said.
I want to interview the crew, too. While there are a half a dozen ships I could get for the trip out, yours is the one that comes with the survivors of Eros.
Naomi looked across at him. Her eyes were carefully neutral.
Was it better to be here, trapped on Ceres while the Rossi was pulled away from him by centimeters, or flying straight into the abyss with his crew? And the ring.
I have to think about it, he said. I'll be in touch.
I respect that, Monica said, but please don't take long. If we're not going with you, we've still got to go with someone. He dropped the connection. In the silence, the deck seemed larger than it was.
This isn't coincidence, Holden said. We just happened to get locked down by Mars, and the only thing that can get us out of the docking clamps just happens to be heading for the ring?
No way. We're being manipulated. Someone's planning this. It's him.
Jim, it's him.
It's Miller.
It's not Miller. He can barely string together a coherent sentence, Naomi said. How is he going to engineer something like this?
Holden leaned forward, and the seat under him shifted. His head felt like it was stuffed with wool.
If we leave, they can still take her away from us, he said.
Once this story is done, we won't be in any better position than we are right now.
Except that we wouldn't be locked on Ceres, Naomi said. And it's a long way out there, a long way back. A lot could change.
That wasn't as comforting as you meant it to be.
Naomi's smile was thin, but not bitter.
Fair point, she said.
The Rosinante hummed around them. The systems running through their automatic maintenance checks, the air cycling gently through the ducts. The ship breathing and dreaming. Their home at rest.
Holden reached out a hand, lacing his fingers with Naomi's.
We still have some money. We can take out a loan, she said. We could buy a different ship. Not a good one, but it wouldn't have to be the end of it all.
It would be, though.
Probably.
No choice then, Holden said. Let's go to Nineveh.
Monica and her team arrived in the early hours of the morning, loading a few small crates of equipment that they carried themselves. In person, Monica was thinner than she seemed on screen. Her camera crew were a sturdy Earth woman named Okju, and a brown-skinned Martian man who went by Clip. The cameras they carried looked like shoulder-mounted weapons, alloy casings that could telescope out to almost 2 meters or retract to fit around the tightest corner in the ship. The sound man was blind. He had a dusting of short, white hair and opaque black glasses. His teeth were yellowed like old ivory, and his smile was gentle and humane. According to the paperwork, his name was Elio Casti. But for some reason, the documentary team all called him Cohen. They assembled in the galley, Holden's four people and Monica's. He could see each group quietly considering the other. They'd been living in one another's laps for months. Strangers trapped in a metal and ceramic box in the vast ocean of the vacuum. Holden cleared his throat.
Welcome aboard, he said.
Chapter 7. Melba. If the Earth-Mars alliance hadn't collapsed, if there hadn't been a war, or two wars, depending on how the line between battles was marked, civilian ships like the Cerisier would have had no place in the Great Convoy. The ships lost at Ganymede and in the Belt, the skirmishes to control those asteroids best placed to push down a gravity well. Hundreds of ships had been lost, from massive engines of war like the Doniger, the Agatha King, and the Hyperion, to countless small 3- and 4-person support ships. Nor, Melba knew, were those the only scars. Phobos, with its listening station, had become a thin, nearly invisible ring around Mars. Eros was gone. Phoebe had been subjected to a sustained nuclear hell and pushed into Saturn. The farms at Ganymede had collapsed. Venus had been used and abandoned by the alien protomolecule. Protogen and the Mao Kwiatkowski Empire, once one of the great shipping and transport companies in the system, had been gutted, stolen, and sold. The Cerisier began her life as an exploration vessel. Now she was a flying tool shed. The bays of scientific equipment were machine shops now. What had once been sealed labs were stacked from deck to deck with the mundane necessities of environmental control networks, scrubbers, ducting, sealants, and alarm arrays. She lumbered through the uncaring vacuum on the fusion plume of her Epstein drive. The crew of 106 souls was made of a small elite of ship command, no more than a dozen all told, and a vast body of technicians, machinists, and industrial chemists. Once, Melba thought, this ship had been on the bleeding edge of human exploration. Once it had burned through the skies of Jovian moons, seeing things humanity had never seen before. Now, it was the hand servant of the government, discovering nothing more exotic than what had been flushed into the water reclamation tanks. The degradation gave Melba a sense of kinship with the ship's narrow halls and gray plastic ladders. Once, Clarissa Melpomene Mao had been the light of her school, popular and beautiful, and suffused with the power and influence of her father's name. Now, her father was a numbered prisoner in a nameless prison, allowed only a few minutes of external connection every day, and those to his lawyer, not his wife or children. And she was Melba Coe, sleeping on a gel couch that smelled of someone else's body and a cabin smaller than a closet. She commanded a team of 4 electrochemical technicians, Stani, Ren, Bob, and Soledad. Stani and Bob were decades older than her. Soledad, 3 years younger, had been on 2 16-month tours. Ren, her official second, was a belter and, like all belters, passionate about environmental control systems the way normal people were with sex or religion. She didn't ask how he'd ended up on an Earth ship, and he didn't volunteer the information. She had known the months going out to the ring would be hard, but she'd misunderstood what the worst parts would be. "She's a fucking bitch, right?" Stani said. It was a private channel between him and Ren. If she'd been who she pretended to be, she wouldn't have been able to hear it. "She doesn't know dick," Ren grunted, neither defending her nor joining the attack. "If you hadn't caught that brownout buffer wrong way on the Macedon last week, it would have been another cascade failure, see, you know? Would have had to throw off the whole schedule to go back and fix it." "Might have," Ren said. She was a level above them. The destroyer Sung Un muttered around her. The crew was on a maintenance run. Scheduled, routine, predictable. They'd left the Cerisier 10 hours earlier in one of the dozen transports that clung to the maintenance ship's skin. They would be here for another 15 hours, changing out the high-yield scrubbers and checking the air supply continuity. The greatest danger, she'd learned, was condensation degrading the seals. It was the kind of detail she should have known. She pulled herself through the access shaft. Her toolkit hung heavy on her front in the full G thrust gravity. She imagined it was what being pregnant would feel like. Unless something strange had happened, Soledad and Bob were sleeping in the boat. Ren and Stani were a level down and going lower with every hour. They were expecting her to make the final inspection of their work, and it seemed they were expecting her to do it poorly. It was true, of course. She didn't know why a real electrochemical technician, seeing her inexperience, should embarrass her as deeply as it did. She'd read a few manuals, run through a few tutorials. All that mattered was that they think she was an authentic, semi-competent overseer. It didn't matter whether they respected her. They weren't her friends. She should have switched to the private frequencies for Soledad and Bob to be certain neither had woken unexpectedly and might come looking for her. This part of the plan was important. She couldn't let any of them find her. But somehow, she couldn't bring herself to shift away from Ren and Stani. She don't do anything, is all. Keeps to her cabin, don't help on the project. She just come out the end, look up, look down, sign off, and go back to her cabin. True. The junction was hard to miss. The bulkhead was reinforced and clearly marked with bright orange safety warnings in five languages. She paused before it, her hands on her hips, and waited to feel some sense of accomplishment. And she did, only it wasn't as pure as she'd hoped. She looked up and down the passageway, though the chances of being interrupted here were minimal. The explosive was strapped against her belly, the heat of her skin keeping it malleable and bright green. As it cooled to ambient, the putty would harden and fade to gray. It surprised her again with its density. Pressing it along the seams of the junction, she felt like she was forming lead with her bare hands. The effort left her knuckles aching before she was halfway done. She'd budgeted half an hour, but it took her almost twice that. The detonator was a black dot, 4 millimeters across, with 10 black ceramic contacts that pressed into the already stiffening putty. It looked like a tick. When she was done, she wiped her hands down with cleaning towelettes twice, making sure none of the explosive was caught under her fingernails or on her clothes. She'd expected to skip her inspection of just the one level, but Ren and Stani had made good time, and she took the lift down 2 levels instead. They were still talking, but not about her now. Stani was considering getting a crush on Soledad. In laconic, belt-inflected half-phrases, Ren was advising against it. Smart man, her second. The lift paused, and 3 soldiers got on it. All men. Melba pressed herself back to make room for them, and the nearest nodded his polite gratitude. His uniform identified him as Marcos. She nodded back, then stared hard at her feet, willing them not to look at her. Her uniform felt like a costume. Even though she knew better, it felt like they would see through her disguise if they looked too close, like her past was written on her skin. "My name is Melba Coe," she thought. "I've never been anyone else." The lift stopped at her level, and the 3 soldiers made way for her. She wondered, when the time came, whether Marcos would die. She had never been to her father's prison, and even if he'd been allowed visitors, the visit would have been in a prescribed room, monitored, transcribed. Any real human emotion would have been pressed out of it by the weight of official attention. She would never have been permitted to see the hallways he walked down or the cell where he slept. But after his incarceration by the United Nations, she'd researched prison design. Her room was 3 centimeters narrower, 1.5 centimeters longer. The crash couch she slept in was gimbaled to allow for changes in acceleration, while his would be welded to the floor. She could squeeze out whenever she wanted to go to the gang showers or the mess. Her door locked from the inside, and there were no cameras or microphones in her room. In every way that mattered, she had more freedom than her father. That she likely spent as much time in isolation was a matter of choice for her, and that made all the difference. Tomorrow would be a fresh rotation out. Another ship, another round of maintenance that she could pretend to oversee. Tonight, she could lie in her couch, dressed in the simple cotton underclothes that she'd bought as the kind of thing Melba would wear. Her hand terminal had 15 tutorials in local memory, and dozens more in the ship's shared storage. They covered everything from microorganic nutrient reclamation to coolant system specifications to management policies. She should have been reading them through. Or, if not that, at least she shouldn't have been reviewing her own secret files. On the screen, Jim Holden looked like a zealot. The composite was built from dozens of hours of broadcast footage of the man, taken over the previous years, with weight given to the most recent images and stills. The software she'd used to make a perfect visual simulacrum of the man cost more than her Melba persona had. The fake Holden had to be good enough to fool both people and computers, at least for a little while. On the screen, his brown eyes squinted with an idiot's earnestness. His jaw had the first presentiment of jowls, only half hidden by the microgravity. The smarmy half-smile told her everything she needed to know about the man who had destroyed her family. "This is Captain James Holden," he said. "What you've just seen is a demonstration of the danger you are in. My associates have placed similar devices on every ship presently in proximity to the ring. You will all stand down, as I am assuming sole and absolute control over the ring in the name of the Outer Planets Alliance. Any ship that approaches the ring without my personal permission will be destroyed without..." She paused it, freezing her small, artificial Holden in mid-gesture. Her fingertip traced the outline of his shoulder, across his cheek, and then stabbed at his eyes. She wished now that she'd picked a more inflammatory script. On Earth, making her preparations, it had seemed enough to have him take unilateral control of the ring. Now, each time she watched it, it seemed tamer. Killing Holden would have been easier. Assassinations were cheap by comparison, but she knew enough about image control and social dynamics to see where it would have led. Martyrdom, canonization, love. A host of conspiracy theories that implicated anyone from the OPA to her father. That was precisely not the point. Holden had to be humiliated in a way that passed backward in time. Someone coming to his legacy had to be able to look back at all the things Holden had done, all the pronouncements he'd given, all the high-handed, self-righteous decisions made on behalf of others while never leaving his control, and see that, of course, it had all led to this. His name, put in with the great traitors, conmen, and self-aggrandizing egomaniacs of history. When she was done, everything Holden had touched would be tainted by association, including the destruction of her family, her father. Somewhere deep in the structure of the Cerisier, one of the navigators started a minor correction burn, and gravity shifted a half a degree. The couch moved under her, and she tried not to notice it. She preferred the times when she could pretend that she was in a gravity well to the little reminders that she was the puppet of acceleration and inertia. Her hand terminal chimed once, announcing the arrival of a message. To anyone who didn't look carefully, it would seem like just another advertisement, an investment opportunity she would be a fool to ignore with a video presentation attached that would seem like corrupted data to anyone who didn't have the decryption key. She sat up, swinging her legs over the edge of the couch, and leaned close to the hand terminal. The man who appeared on her screen wore black glasses, dark enough to be opaque. His hair was cropped close to his skull, but she could see from the way it moved that he was under heavy burn. The sound man cleared his throat. "The package is delivered,
and ready for testing. I'd appreciate the balance transfer as soon as you've confirmed. I've got some bills coming due, and I'm a little under the wire. Something in the background hissed, and a distant voice started laughing. A woman. The file ended. She replayed it 4 more times. Her heart was racing, and her fingers felt like little electric currents were running through them. She'd need to confirm, of course. But this was the last, most dangerous step. The Rosinante had been cutting-edge military hardware when it had fallen into Holden's hands. There could also have been any number of changes made to the security systems in the years since. She set up a simple remote connection looped through a disposable commercial account on Ceres Station. It might take days for the Rosinante's acknowledgement to come back to her, saying that the back door was installed and functioning, that the ship was hers. But if it did, it was the last piece. Everything in place. A sense of almost religious well-being washed over her. The thin room with its scratched walls and 2 bright LEDs had never seemed so benign. She levered herself up out of the couch. She wanted to celebrate, though of course there was no one she could tell. Talk to might be enough. The halls of the Cerisier were so narrow that it was impossible to walk abreast or to pass someone coming the opposite way without turning sideways. The mess would fit 20 people sitting with their hips touching. The nearest thing to an open area was the fitness center off the medical bay. The treadmills and exercise machines required enough room that no one would be caught in the joints and belts. Safety regulations made it the widest, freest air in the ship, and so a good place to be around people. Of her team, only Ren was present. In the usual microgravity, he would probably have been neck deep in a tank of resistance gel. With the full G burn, he was on a regular treadmill. His pale skin was bright with sweat, his carrot-orange hair pulled back in a frizzed ponytail. It was strange watching him. His large head was made larger by his hair, and the thinness of his body made him seem more like something from a children's program than an actual man. He nodded to her as she came in. "Ren," she said, walking to the front of his machine. She felt the gazes of other crewmen on her, but on the Cerisier she didn't feel as exposed. Or maybe it was the good news that carried her. "Do you have a minute?" "Chief," he said instead of yes, but he thumbed down the treadmill to a cool-down walk. "Que ça?" "I heard some of the things Stani was saying about me," she said. Ren's expression closed down. "I just wanted..." She frowned, looked down, and then gave in to the impulse welling up in her. "He's right," she said. "I'm in over my head with this job. I got it because of some political favors. I'm not qualified to do what I'm doing." He blinked rapidly. He shot a glance around her, checking to see if anyone had overheard them. She didn't particularly care, but she thought it was sweet that he did. "Not so bad, you," he said. "I mean, little off here, little off there. But I've been under worse." "I need help," she said. "To do all the work the way it should be done, I need help. I need someone I can trust. Someone I can count on." Ren nodded, but his forehead roughened. He blew out his breath and stepped off the treadmill. "I want to get the work done right," she said, "not miss anything. And I want the team to respect me."
"Okay, sure."
"I know you should have had this job." Ren blew out another breath, his cheeks ballooning. It was more expressive than she'd ever seen him before. He leaned against the wall. When he met her gaze, it was like he was seeing her for the first time.
"Appreciate you saying it, Chief, but we're both of us outsiders here," he said. "Stick together, bien?"
"Good," she said.
leaning against the wall next to him. So, the brownout buffers? What did I get wrong? Wren sighed.
The buffers are smart, but the design's stupid, he said. They talk to each other, so they're also a separate network, yeah? Thing is, you put one in the wrong way, works okay. But next time it resets, the signal down the line looks wrong. Triggers a diagnostic run and the next one down, and then the next one down. Whole network starts blinking like Christmas. Too many errors on the network and it fails closed, takes down the whole grid. And then you got us going through checking each one by hand, with flashlights and the supervisor chewing our nuts. That can't be right, she said. Seriously? It could have shut down the grid?
I know, right? Wren said, smiling. And all it would take is change the design so it don't fit in if you got it wrong. But they never do. A lot of what we do is like that, boss. We try to catch the little ones before they get big. Some things, you get them wrong, it's nothing. Some things, and it's a big mess. The words felt like a church bell being struck. They resonated. She was that fault, that error. She didn't know what she was doing. Not really. And she'd get away with it. She'd pass. Until she didn't. And then everything would fall apart. Her throat felt tighter. She almost wished she hadn't said anything. She was a brownout buffer, pointed the wrong way. A flaw that was easy to overlook, with the potential to wreck everything. For the others, don't take them harsh. Blowing off steam, mostly. Not you so much as it's anything. Fear-biting. Fear? Sure, he said. Everyone on this boat's scared dry. Try not to show it. Do the work. But we all get nightmares. Natural, right? What are they afraid of? She asked. Behind her, the door cycled open and shut. A man said something in a language he didn't know. Wren tilted his head, and she had the sick, sinking feeling that she'd done something wrong. She hadn't acted normal, and she didn't know what her misstep was. Ring, he said at last. It's what killed Eros. Could have killed Mars. All that weird stuff it did on Venus, no one knows what it was. Deaded that slingshot kid who went through. Half everyone thinks we should be pitching nukes at it. Other half thinks we'd only piss it off. We're going out as deep as anyone ever has, just so we can look in the devil's eye. And Stani and Sole and Bob? They're all scared as shit of what we see in it. Me too. Ah, she said. All right, I understand that. Wren tried on a smile. You? It don't scare you? It's not something I think about.
Chapter 8. Anna. Nami and Nono left for Earth a week before Anna's shuttle. Those last days, living alone in those rooms, knowing that she would never be back, that they would never be back, was like a gentle presentiment of death, profoundly melancholy and, shamefully, a little exhilarating. The shuttle from Europa was one of the last to join the flotilla, and it meant 18 hours of hard burn. By the time she set foot on the deck of the UNN Thomas Prince, all she wanted was a bunk and 12 hours' sleep. The young yeoman who'd been sent to greet and escort her had other plans, though, and the effort it would have taken to be rude about it was more than she could muster. The Prince is a Xerxes-class battleship, or what we sometimes refer to as a third-generation dreadnought, he said, gesturing to the white ceramic over gel of the hangar's interior walls. The shuttle she'd arrived on nestled in its bay, looking small under the cathedral-huge arch. We call it a third-generation battleship
because it is the third redesign since the build-up during the first Earth-Mars conflict. Not that it had been